open the floor and off we go. Who would like to start? About half an hour.
From memory, I think you've got a bit of a reputation, for fine tuning your plays right up to the last minute. So I was just wondering, with obviously the state Dragon's Trilogy, where it literally will be different or a little bit different from previous.
Well, actually, this is a remount of a show we created about 20 years ago. It's something that I toured for about 4 years, and the way the company works is that we don't really know what we're doing when we start, we just start. And eventually, with time, we characters come out, eventually storylines and all that, and it becomes a story. But the story is never written down until we finish performing it. And so after 4 years, we pretty much thought that the Dragon's Trilogy was written. And so then we put it to rest and went on and did tons of other stuff. And when we decided to do it again, we said, well, this is going to be an easy job because we just take it, it's already written, and we do it. To discover that, of course, we had become other, you know, we had evolved, we had matured, we were very different people by then, and we decided to rewrite a lot of it. So the first part of the trilogy is pretty much intact. The second one was restructured, and the third part was almost completely rewritten. And so we started touring it, and so we're in the same process, I'd say, that we were when we first created it. We're still performing it, meaning that we're still changing it, and we're still... sometimes I get the opportunity to be with the company, and so then there's a lot of rewriting that happens at that moment. There's other moments where they're quite happy that I'm not around because they just go and do 4 or 5 performances in a row without changing anything. But it's still evolving, and also part of the evolution is not just the relationship with the audiences, it's also within the company itself. It's a very demanding show, and sometimes we have to replace actors. Or actors get a contract somewhere, or they do a film, whatever. So every new participant comes in with his own energy and his own ideas. So the roles and the text and the story evolves accordingly also. So we try. I mean, that's, I guess, what company, why we like doing theater, because it's such a, it's a living life form, and you have to accept that. You know, it's going to be evolving, and that's probably what the theater was in Shakespeare's time. Just, you know, we don't want it to be that way because we'd like it to be finished and final, but it always kind of moves around.
So I guess for Wellington, it'll be just that little bit of something here that hasn't been seen before.
I'd say that, as I said, it's mainly in the third part. The third part is set in 1985, and when we first... did the Dragon's Trilogy, it was 1985, so it was a contemporary thing that we were doing first. Now it's a period piece. And because it's a lot about our relationship with the idea of China, that has evolved so much, and we're pretty much in tune with what goes on in China right now, economically, the Olympics, culturally. So we're readjusting what we're doing accordingly. And I think that the audience feels that what we do is always pretty much up to date because of that, because we let that influence us. When we did the Seven Streams of the River Ota here at Wellington, actually, we got to perform our very, very last performance here in Wellington. And at that point, all the collaborators felt, okay, well, this is pretty much what the show is, and now we can sit down and write it. So we wrote it down, and as we were writing it down, we said, no, this one day will be revived. We'll probably have to, because, you know, there's pockets of things that feel unfinished.
Well, but 6 hours is a long time to sustain audience interest. Yeah. Are you planning to do that? What's your response to that?
Do a good show. No, people forget, I think, that actually that's what theatre used to be. You know, even in Molière's time or Shakespeare, I mean, you know, Hamlet was a 5-hour play. And intervals are as important as what goes on stage. It's a social event. There are 3 intervals in Dragon's Trilogy. There's food. It's not just about telling a story, it's also having a community come together and talk and say, okay, well, what do you gather from this, or who is this character, and what people say and explain to each other is as important. I think the play always surprises people, a bit like the Seven Streams. People buy the tickets and they sit and say, well, I'll probably stay for 1 or 2 parts and then I'll go, but, and end up staying the whole length because they were drawn into the story. And also, we're used today to going to see spectacles that are pretty much imitating film. Film is a very compact, practical thing. You know, it's an hour and a half, an hour 40. And after that, you catch the last bus and you could go home. And the babysitter costs this. But these big events ask of you to enter somebody else's world, to accept that time will be stretched and all sorts of... And that your interest is going to be you're going to be swallowed by a story. You're not going to be consuming a story. You're going to be swallowed by it. So there's a lot of things going on in the Dragon's Trilogy. It's a game also. The audience is I think as captivated as they are by sport. You know, they understand that there are rules and there are all these things going on. And, so I think that we've grown accustomed to shorten things, but. When you embark into this kind of journey, usually people let themselves go and they're very happy to spend the 4 days. Of course, the seats have to be very comfortable. As long as something we don't control, you know, we can't inspect every venue. But,
and it starts early.
I'm sorry.
And it starts early.
It starts early. Yeah, but we have to start around. I think what's it?
Various times, some of them are two in the afternoon, some of them are
Yeah. But people hang around afterwards. That's the thing that's interesting about these shows is that they, even if it sometimes it finishes at 7 or 8, and they spend a full day in the theater, and they just don't want to leave the premises
because they think they've forgotten who they are and where they live.
Well, probably by that time. But no, I think it's people have a lot of questions after, and they just wonder and they. Because, as I say, part of the spectacle is also the gathering of a community. You know, if you go to see a show and you do it in an anonymous way for an hour and a half, that's one experience. But if you go to spend a full day with people, you know, it's really a social thing, and you want to continue that. You want, you know, friendships are, bonds are made in these events.
I want to ask a question about content and style, because I've seen one or two people attempt to emulate your work, and I seem to have got some of the external things sort of looking more or less right. But it seems to me that what's absolutely fundamental to your work is that you do honour those major fundamental concepts of good drama, that is, the characters are very strong. Their wants and needs are very driving in them. They go through a journey. They're called into action by a request or into inaction by a quest or into inaction by the things that get in the way. Are these conscious fundamentals that you address?
Well, they're not conscious. I mean, we're aware of those important ingredients in drama, but we don't force ourselves towards that. There's a moment where we ask these questions, where we write a story, and eventually we go, "Oh my God, what's at stake here? Are the stakes high enough to make it?" And then we do ask these questions, but that comes later into the process. I'd say that probably what makes our work, when it works, what makes it universal, is the fact that it's very local. It's about what goes on in your kitchen and in your backyard. It's about that. It's not. Unfortunately, we've bumped into a lot of companies who say they do universal stuff, but they do international stuff. That's very different. You know, they try to appeal to international taste. You know, we have CNN and Fox News to do that for us. Art should be much more about the personal, about the intimate, about the world that you understand around you. And I think that that's why people identify to it so much, that sometimes they don't always understand the language or the accent or the exact context, but we're much more, as audiences, we're much more connected to something that comes from abroad that we don't think we'll have any connections to, and finally discover that it's about us. You know?
You do find an epic scale of intimate experience, don't you?
And
find a way of...
Yes, but as I say, it's those things come later on, I guess, because of our training, and we do have a certain consciousness about these things, but we try not to... the thing that's interesting is that any theatre writer or any artist, for that matter, will say simplicity in art is the best thing. You know, let's make it simple. One actor, one chair, one light. And say, well, yes, I also think that's wonderful, but you can't start there. You have to start... It has to be complete chaos. It has to be a complete mess. And simplicity comes with time. Simplicity will impose itself. It will eventually you will shed all those external things and you will find what it is that you want to say in the simplest, most poetic and artistic and entertaining way. But that comes at the end. You can't start there. And that's why I try not to shy off. When we start, people come in with tons of things and gadgets and we try everything. You need to allow that to happen, and eventually the more you rehearse and the more you perform also, because a lot of that shedding comes from performance, you know, the more the audience gives you feedback and all that, the more you sculpt what it is that you're doing, and it just keeps the strongest elements and makes what it is that you want to say very, very clear, but we never start there.
The process that you described is like a distillation of things, is it? So that when, for instance, Far Side of the Moon, the notion of reflection became a very core metaphor for both reflecting the truth and deflecting.
Well, the thing is that if you start writing a story, like for example, in the Far Side of the Moon, it became a lot about narcissism and mirrors and reflections, as you say, but it appeared by accident, because in the rehearsal room there was a big mirror on the wall, you know.
Right.
So, and eventually there you are trying to tell a story with all sorts of other elements, and then you look at the mirror and say, well, this would do a better job because of this, and you discover that the actual mirror is carrying with it all sorts of themes and sub-themes and things like that, and it's a much richer element to be working with.
So there is a moment of conscious recognition.
Yeah,
value,
but you have to have an eye for it.
Yeah.
You have to have, you have to go, okay, I think, but you have to allow yourself to be influenced by everything, that's for sure.
Thank you.
Which would be more, a seminar show or a 10-minute show?
I'd say the 10-minute show, because the thing is for the audience to feel satisfied. You come out of a show and want to feel that you've been moved and you've been you've laughed, you've been informed, you feel more empowered. And that's what our job should be as performers or artists in general, is that the audience comes out feeling empowered. You know, they know something they did not know. They feel they can do something they didn't feel they could do, whatever. So, and to convey that in 7 hours or 9 hours, like our next project is 9 hours. So to convey that in 9 hours, I think is much easier than in 10 minutes to get that idea across. And, I guess that's why people who do 1-minute commercials on TV get paid so much when they're really good, is that it's, you know, and we're in this very, very, very fast-moving world where... I think it would be more difficult. But there was one thing, though, that I think is very important to understand how we work, though, in that sense, is that, you know, the audiences today may not be necessarily cultivated or educated, but they're very intelligent, and they know what storytelling is, because they're much more exposed to it than we were 25, 30 years ago. Theater is one way of telling a story. But the audiences today are exposed to film and to rock videos and commercials or whatever. So the storytelling narrative systems are very, very, very varied and very sophisticated. So the audience would never say this to you. They'd never say, oh, I know what a flashback is or a flash forward. They would never talk in these terms. But they know, they're used to be, to do that mental exercise. So the problem with theater today is that you go to the theater and you're at the end of the play before the actors are. People are at the end of the story, and you feel that the audience is bored because they're going faster than you are. So that's why I'm not saying that. I don't have the pretension to say that we're faster than the audience, but we're trying to go at least at the same speed as them. You know, we're trying to. And the way to do that is to use their vocabulary. To say, okay, this they would understand, this they would use, this they're used to. So in a certain sense, even if it is theater that we do, it is very filmic, it's very televisual, it's using the vocabularies and a very pure theater artist will tell you, you know, they will never want to, you know, theater is a pure thing, has, well, yes, but then the art is, the craft is going to die if you don't. So I'm very preoccupied by that. And when I feel the audience is going faster than I am, I go, well, there's something wrong here. We have to take shortcuts, or we have to use a language that they will be, drag on to what we're doing and not us dragging behind.
Do you use the same approach with the film work that you do?
I try to. I don't know as much about film as I do as theater. I'm not saying that I know a lot of theater, but I mean is that I feel I'm much more of a theater person than a film person. I'm interested in film a lot. But I don't master it very well. I don't understand it very well. It's a very, very capricious and very young art form. Film is only 110 years old, something like that. You know? So we think we know what are the rules of films, but it's still being developed. We're still trying to understand how it works. I'm interested in film because it's yet another way of telling stories. And it's also a way, because a lot of my films are a film adaptation of a play. So sometimes you think you've pretty much understand what it is that you're, the story that you're telling, but a film allows you at the end of the process to maybe go further into certain things. For example, in The Far Side of the Moon, as an actor, I felt I could go deeper into the subject matter in the film, but as an actor. But the visual language, the staging, and all of that, I think is much stronger in the play. The play is much more poetic, much more exciting. But to get to play the two parts, the two siblings on screen, is a much much more difficult and much more profound approach, I'd say, than in the theater. In the theater, you just, I would slap on a pair of glasses and a goatee and I would do the other character. But in film, you have to, you know, with close-ups, you have to really, really, really indulge into the energy of the characters and really find the difference. So that's, I'm interested in film for what it can do that theater cannot. But otherwise, I don't really understand the craft well enough.
What is your nine-hour piece about? Mm.
It's about the human voice. As I say, all our shows, we don't really know where it's going. I don't know where this one is going at all, but the thing is that we were interested in the word lip sync. It's a working title for now. And this idea of real voice, false voice, borrowed voice, translation, which is something we're also very, very exposed to. And just the fact that, I mean, I always start by the subject matter is always things that are, that we don't understand and that we're trying to inquire about. So, I've always been afraid of dogs. Well, not small dogs, but I've been afraid of dogs. You know? And one of my friends has this mean big dog, and whose vocal cords have been cut off because he was barking all the time. So the neighbors complained, and he had to have his. So, anyways, it's this huge giant dog that I pet, and he barks at me nonstop. But because there's no sound, I'm not afraid of him. And I'm trying to understand what that is about. But that's just one aspect. Of course, we have 9 hours of show. So it's about many, many other things. You know, it's about the film industry. It's about dubbing. It's about all these other things. But we always start. Everybody in the company brings in something about the voice and that they want to understand. And that, for me, that's one thing. You know, and why we all freaked out by the. Why were we all freaked out by the Ayatollah Khomeini? It's because he was barking, you know? And that's what I mean. So it's this thing about how voice is authority and what it contains and how you could charm someone with your voice and the power of voice. And also because Ex Machina's work is, even though we never start with an image, our work is very highly visual, and our reputation is that we do a lot of physical theater and we integrate media and things like that, which is true, but that's not really what we're about, but that's the reputation we have. So we said, well, if we really start something that is really oral and vocal, and, you know, we could maybe prove that we're also about, you know, there's an aspect to our work that is also very different. So there's 9 collaborators, they each have an hour to come up with some kind of story, and then we try to intertwine all the different stories to see how the characters are going to be related, and eventually it becomes a huge, huge fresco.
How long is your rehearsal period?
It varies. I'd say this is always like a first. Well, with time we've developed the system, but it was very vague at the beginning. But with time we've developed the system where we meet for a week and we just sit around the table and talk, and there's a bit of people bring stuff, and we leave that there. And then months go by and people do other things, and after maybe 2-3 months we come back to the table, and then we have a 3-week period where we do what we call exploration, which is also improv and all sorts of things. So we do that for about 3 weeks, and you know, ideas come out, the characters, situations, but it's all very, very loose. And at the end of that first 3 weeks, we do what we call a public rehearsal. That kind of forces us to present something, you know, to incarnate some of the ideas. So we avoid inviting journalists and critics and reviewers. We try to leave them out of the process for a while. We invite audiences who pay $5, and we fill the room. It's unannounced. We just kind of gather 200 people in a room, and we perform. And after that, there's a party, and people talk to us and all that. So we do a couple of those. Then after that, another few months go by, and then we sit again, but that time we sit for 4 weeks. And then we try to do a first version of our production. So, of course, you know, this is like long shows like Dragon's Trilogy or Seventh Stream. You know, we do it in increments. The first time that we created Seven Streams, we did 3 parts of the 7 parts. But it's still a 3-hour show. You know, so we start touring, and then eventually all the other increments get added. So it's, I'd say, a 7 or 8 week rehearsal, but it's not really called rehearsal. And then we start touring. And it's really, the writing really happens with the audience. That's really where, I'd say, the dialogue starts. But we try to keep it open to whatever happens.
So at what point do you decide the length? I can see where you came up with the 9-hour, if there's 9 collaborators, but for such a 7-hour, I mean, if it's an evolving process, at what point do you put a time on the channel?
Well, there's all this kind of numerology. I mean, we're not superstitious or anything, but numbers come with mathematics come with a system of their own. So when we did the 7 streams, for example, we started and we were all into number 12, and we all believed in 12, and 12 was the 12 gods of this, and there's the 12 months of the year, and we all thought that 12 is fantastic. And after 2 weeks of rehearsal, we said, I think it's going to be 7. and 7 ended up being a more magical number because the river that went through Hiroshima had 7 streams, and we thought, okay, it's a more poetic thing. Then we went to 7 different directions, but it all goes into Hiroshima. And so then we said, okay, well, it has to be 7 parts. And then we say, well, probably 7 hours, because an hour, audiences, I think, can take an hour and 10 without moving or going to the washroom or running away from it. So we thought, okay, well, then it should be around 7 hours. And we know that the 7 hours is going to be intercut by different intervals, and we try to take that into account. But those numbers kind of impose themselves for symbolic reasons and structural reasons. And for example, the number 9, it's because in film, because we know it's going to be connected a lot to the theme of cinema. And they used to be, before the digital world, things would always be divided into 10 reels, and 9 reels. And it was all about how you cut things into 9. This is kind of storytelling system that is in 9 acts. So we thought it was an interesting starting point, but it might change. You know, once we get into the nitty-gritty of it, you know, maybe it'll go to 12 this time around. I don't know. We'll see. But we try to keep it open but these things are good guidelines. So when we did the Dragon's Trilogy, 3 was very important because we were all based on Mahjong and Hai King and a lot of things that went by 3, you know, and so it became, and also the 3 dragons. And
so you're
if a collaborator comes up with 80 minutes of really good stuff and someone else comes up with 40 minutes of really good stuff, are you going to demand the 80s cut to 60 and the 40s grown to 60?
No, not necessarily. No, we try to let things kind of shed themselves. We take things for what they are and we present them like they are. Something that is recurrent is that I do a lot of solo shows also, because those are big collective works, and I love doing that, but there's a lot personally that cannot be expressed in a group. You compromise, and if you want it to happen, you have to say, well, I'll put a bit of water in my wine here, and I'll just... So there's a lot of things that pile up, and I feel every 4 or 5 years that I have to do a solo show. The solo shows usually are 2 hours long. So this new show that I just did in Sydney, called The Anderson Project, it's a solo show that when I first performed it in Quebec City, it was 3 hours long. But now it's kind of sifted itself through performance, and now it's a 2-hour. But also because it's in English right now, so English is much shorter than French. It's at least 10 minutes shorter than French. And so it's pretty much, and Far Side was around 2 to 10. And, all the one-man shows kind of naturally go to that. But there's probably standards that establish themselves.
Also, well, the idea of your one-man shows, and then you give that show to another actor. How's that process?
Well, it's strange because it always starts by, when I perform it, I always think that this one will never be, I'll never be able to hand this one off to anybody else. I'm only me, and it's all so personal, and it's all about me. And then eventually you do it, and you go, well, no, somebody else could actually step in eventually and do something with it. And there's a moment where you feel, as a performer, that you've pretty much brought to the piece what you could bring, and you have to have the humility of saying, well, a better actor would do something even better, and certainly someone like Eve, when Eve took over Far Side, Eve didn't have all the preoccupation of writing this, and talking about himself and stuff, but he brought in his own stuff into it, and then you could really make it evolve and push it further. So I kind of walk out of it in a very, very civilized and satisfied manner.
How long does it take you to be able to walk away from it?
I'd say a couple of years. Yeah. It's also because the festival network, the map of the festival networks, there are parts of the world that I'm really interested in doing these things, and there's parts of the world that wait till we've toured it 2 years, so for example, this is certainly one place I would have wanted to do Far Side, but we decided all of this so late into the process, by that time we had switched to Eden. But the next time I hope to grab the people here I'd like to come here, to be here soon enough to be able to do it myself.
You're obviously still optimistic about the art of the theatre, but are you still pessimistic about the art of film? Which I've already said somewhere. Mm-hmm.
Well, yes, I'm very pessimistic at this moment. No, I know I'm optimistic about one thing. I think that if this gets too complicated, tell me and I'll just take a shortcut. But it's just that the problem with film right now, and I don't know how it is here in New Zealand, because I know there's a kind of a rebirth and all of that. But in Canada, what's very difficult is that the money goes to the big popular entertainment. And, that's okay, that's fair. If they're money makers, it's okay that you invest in that. It's just that the art of film, or the OTA film form, is dying in Canada right now, and because they don't recognize that international recognition is worth local box office. They won't do that. So it's a bit depressing, because a lot of filmmakers in Canada who have extraordinary talents are not being given money to do their films. So the reason why that is also is because the people who control the film industry are the distributors. The distributors have the reels of your film under their arm, and they decide to show it or not. And if they show it, to how many people they show it, and they decide. So you don't have, absolutely, as an artist, no control. Until it's like, as long as it's like that, it's a very depressing thing to be doing film. But that will change, and it has changed because of the digital age. And that means that eventually, and more people are doing that. The fact that now film is only on stock, an artist cannot have that in his office and decide to show it or not. It's in the hands of the distributor. But from the moment it becomes digital and high quality enough to be shown side by side to 35 millimeter, then you could eliminate distributors. You could eliminate a lot of people who are keeping your work to finding its audience. And also, film will become more interesting because it will be like theater, in the sense that you beam it to some satellite in some rooms that are equipped, and when you go and see somebody's work, and critics and audiences will react to it, and the day after you could change it and make it evolve and make it a real jewel. Mm-hmm. And the guillotine of opening night will not exist anymore. And that's one of the big problems of film right now. It's burdened and it's strangled by its own technology. But as that evolves and becomes more... And that's happening in also just hints of that. You know, the last film I did was digital, and a week before this first presentation, we shifted two reels, and redid the sound overnight. You couldn't do that the year before. And we're going towards that kind of thing, where people will be not tailoring their film to the taste of the audience, but reacting to what the audience understands, doesn't understand, what critics say about films, and using that and re-inject it into the whole process, and stop seeing it as much as a market, but seeing it much more as a storytelling medium, like it used to be, what it's supposed to be. So I have faith in that, but that will take time, unfortunately.
So we've got time for one more question.
Yes.
Speaking of money, where do you get the resources to work the way you work?
Okay. Well, arts and theatre in Canada is correctly funded. I'm not saying very well funded, because it has its problems. But it's correctly funded, but you can't work the way I do with that money. So what we do is, because about 20 years ago, we embarked on this big network of festivals. You bump into co-producers and people who want your next work and all of that. So I'd say 80% of the company's subsidies come from outside of Canada, come from festivals, come from rights, things like that, and maybe almost 20% come from different governmental subsidies in Canada. So we've become a very comfortable company where we can allow ourselves to work any which way we want. And it's not, we're not rolling in Cadillacs or anything like that. It's just that we've changed the production structure of our creations. It's just that if you're going to be, if you're going to be changing the shape of the cake, you have to change the shape of the mold. And so that's where the production structures of what we do are adapt to whatever it is that we do. We say to our executive producer, well, this time we're doing a 5.5-hour show that will have dance and a bit of visual arts. They structure it and sell it and co-produce it in that manner, and they make sure that it's the work first. And we're not burdened by a theater, which is often a lot of companies want to have their stage, and they have to sell tickets, and they have to. We're not stuck by any. We're not strangled by any of that. We don't run a theater. We have a company. We tour, and we count on this wealth of interests around the world. People wanting to buy the shows or co-produce them in advance. And,
do you have your own rehearsal rooms all the time?
We have a center now in Quebec City. The mayor gave us an old fire hall. And so we have a studio there, and we have rehearsal rooms, and we have equipment, and we have all of that. So, but as I say, it's not a theater. It's a lab. And we take observers from all over the world who come, who collaborate with us.
Just by way of wrapping up, can we just ask what people can expect
at
the Dragon's Trilogy?
Okay, well, actually, the Dragon's Trilogy is a very moving piece about two young French-Canadian women, and you follow their life. But if their life lines will bring you through the different Chinatowns of Canada, their faith kind of makes you over a 75-year span, you follow their lives and their faiths, but it puts you in touch with the relationship of Canada and the Chinese community, and how that also has evolved, how we went from having in the 30s a very secluded, ghettoized Chinatown, and how that idea has evolved, and how today, for example, in Vancouver, it's pretty much an Asian town now. It's 60% of the population in Vancouver is Asian, and Hong Kong took over when Hong Kong was given back to China in 1987. In 85, loads of very rich Hong Kong people moved to Vancouver and took over the city. And all that. So it's an interesting kind of. It looks like a very very melodramatic story about two young French Canadian women, but it's actually is a much more profound and there's a lot of connections with how we deal today with themes like racism and reconciliation between East and West.